When Hannah, my wife, and I got engaged, it was raining outside. Rubbish! It ruined my plan to get down on one knee with the sun setting, overlooking this beautiful lake outside this kind of hotel restaurant that I'm pretty sure I had vouchers for, but I can't quite remember. Clouds, rain, typical English evening. So I went to the reception desk and asked if there was a room that they could spare so I could ask my wife to marry me. The reception lady got up and walked me down a corridor and opened up a door to this bedroom. Will this do it? She said. I mean, it was literally a bed in a room. I was like, possibly sending the wrong signal. So she took me over to this storage cupboard and said, this is basically all we've got. And inside was just stacks and stacks of chairs and tables. She said, go wait at the bar and I will be 10 minutes. Now Hannah was waiting and kind of looking slightly confused at this point. I got a drink for her, and while that was happening, this reception lady just jumped up from behind the bar, holding a bottle of champagne. I thought, oh man, am I paying for that? And then just disappeared. And after about 10 minutes, she called us over and told me that the room was ready. We walked into a completely transformed room. Flowers at the table, champagne bubbling away. How much is that going to be? And kind of low lighting, it was quiet, it was brilliant. I got down on one knee and asked Hannah to marry me, and she said yes. Can you imagine what it would have been like if she had then pulled out a contract and began to negotiate terms of the relationship? Now, Aaron, I've been waiting for this, so how much time off am I going to get? We obviously need to distribute the house tasks fairly, so which ones am I going to be required to do? Also, what proportion of your income is going to be mine for me to spend on the things that I want? Can you imagine that sort of relationship? Can you imagine what that would be? Now, sadly, many people view Christianity like that. I'm free to do what I want until I sign the contract of Christianity, and then I give up my contract-free life and then have to serve God. I have a life where I'm able to do what I want, but God is saying to me that I need to sign my life away and come under contract with Him. It's contractual Christianity. It's simply fulfilling the terms of an agreement. And when we preach about being in a relationship with God, all they hear is being in contract with God. Can I say, if that's you, then Paul here is telling you that you've got it literally the wrong way around. Our world believes it is free, but actually it's under contract. It views Christianity as contractual, but actually we are free. It's usually at this point that we look at the context, so we look at the verses around the passage that we're looking at. I'll let you read verse 12 in your own time. Awkward. What's got Paul so riled up? What's got him so angry? It's because people had come into the Galatian church holding contracts. They were saying that the people had to do stuff, including circumcision, which is why he mentions it in verse 12, so that they could be in a relationship with God. They were promoting contractual Christianity. Sign your life away on this contract, and then you can be in a relationship with God. But it isn't really a relationship. It's more kind of a business partnership. As long as you keep doing the good things, then he will uphold his end too. What's Paul's response? Verse 13 says, "You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free." Contractual Christianity isn't Christianity because there is no contract. We are free. And what does that freedom mean? What does it mean to be free people? Now, he tells us three ways that we are free. Three surprising and countercultural ways that we can enjoy freedom. Are you ready to go through these? Are you ready to see how your contract has been ripped up and you are called to be free? Here is the first way that we can enjoy our freedom. We are free to serve. You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. What is the cry of our culture at the moment? Do what you feel. That is freedom. You are free when you are your feelings. It's part of the reason why Frozen was such a popular film. Elsa was trying to suppress her feelings, trying to push down her powers until she finally let loose. She finally accepted who she was, and then she became free. I am my feelings. This is me. The cold never bothered her anyway. Our culture says that if you have to suppress your real feelings, then you are under contract. The terms and conditions are suppress your feelings and enjoy relationship. Wear a mask. Don't be you. If you fulfill those criteria, then we could be friends. And they're absolutely right. That's not freedom, is it? But Paul here is saying that actually there is a real problem when people simply do exactly what they feel. If everyone did what they felt like doing, we wouldn't end up with real freedom. We'd end up with anarchy. Who are you to tell me what I should do? I should be whoever I feel. I should be, and I should do whatever I feel I should do. Do you know how that ends? Verse 15, if you bite and devour each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed. People who have no control over their feelings can destroy churches. Now, one of the great things about the film Frozen is that it finishes with Elsa realizing that she is in control of her feelings, and when she does that, she finds real joy in serving others. She finds her freedom by being the best queen of Arendelle that she can be. Paul here is saying the same thing. You've got it the wrong way round if you think that serving yourself is freedom and serving others is slavery. No, serving your feelings is slavery, and serving others in love is freedom. We are called by God into freedom and the joy of humble, loving service of others. If you're still feeling uncomfortable with that definition, then keep exploring with me, because Paul keeps going. Here's the second point. We are free to be led. I told you this was countercultural. So verse 18, if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. And I did a master's degree that focused on Christian leadership. It became very obvious early on that there is a big difference between leadership and management. Management basically focuses on tasks. Leadership focuses on vision. It focuses on why we're doing the tasks. A quote popped up online this week from a French guy born in the 1900s. He said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up people together to collect wood, and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. There you go. Pop that on your Facebook wall this week. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people together to collect wood, and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. There is a joy in sharing a vision with people who are leading you, right? So if you want someone to work late, you don't tell them to do so. You give them a reason to do so. Walking with the Spirit is sharing his vision. It's keeping in step with the Spirit, and it's working at the things that he is working at. Being led by the Spirit is following his desires. Paul doesn't sugarcoat this. He's saying that being led by the Spirit isn't always going to be comfortable, because the Spirit is at war. He's at war with our feelings, and you need to choose a side. So verse 17, for the flesh desires what is contrary to the spirit, and the spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They are in conflict with each other, so that you are not to do whatever you want. What are the things our feelings want us to do? Now, I realise it's probably likely that there are children in earshot here. Now, particularly now, as I have mentioned Frozen. So let me be careful with how this next bit is worded. Look down at the list of verses 19 to 21. Look at what he starts and finishes with. The contract our culture is promoting right now is that it doesn't matter what we do with our bodies. That is what you have to sign up to. Keep going down the list. Our cultural contract is saying that to be part of us, then you have to not care about the spiritual realm. But it matters how we interact with the spiritual realm, doesn't it? And before you go on a witch hunt, maybe keep reading and have a look at the plank in your own eye. Hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition. You'll notice there, ambition is okay. It's okay to be an ambitious Christian. Selfish ambition is not. Dissensions, factions. Is God happy with those who cause division? Do your kids, colleagues, or friends see you as someone who constantly disagrees, who constantly fights, who always has something to say, whose feelings are saying that they must fight to be right all the time? Are you someone who promotes division rather than unity? What would your friends or colleagues say? What would your kids say? What would your spouse say? Remember, a marriage can be buried with 1,000 little digs. Look at the last two items on the list. I'm not going to explore these much, but partly because I preached on the first one of those two previously, and I think they speak for themselves. I would avoid Googling the last one, just a flag. Surely once or twice is fine, Paul. Surely it's okay. I'm free to do what I want. Look, you're just trying to get me into a contract. It even says that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. That is a contract. No, it's not. It's a deeply loving relationship. All the way through the passage, Paul speaks about love being the fulfillment of the law. Did you notice? We have a responsibility to fulfill the moral law. Of course we do. That moral law isn't an oppressive contract. It's how we engage with a deeply loving relationship. If I got engaged to my wife and she had pulled out a contract for me to sign that said no adultery, no flirting with other women, no murder, definitely no attempted murder, no using my toothbrush or my hairbrush, as if that would make a difference. No, that contract is fulfilled if I say these three words to her: I love you. I love you and I will always love you. Won't that always fulfill the obligations of my marriage? If I kind of dabble with adultery, I'm not going to inherit a happy marriage. If you live like this list, you will not inherit the kingdom of God. You're not being led by the Spirit. You are gratifying the desires of your flesh. And the outcome is eternal destruction of the one relationship you will forever regret not investing in. Your relationship with your Creator, who loves you. Okay, Paul, so now you've shown me where my desires lead. Now I know that freedom isn't just following my feelings. What does it mean to be free from those desires? What's the vision? What is going to be the outcome? What are you leading me towards? And this is the last point. We are free to grow together. Want to know something I find useful in remembering the 9 fruit of the Spirit? Think of them as groups of 3 that describe the development of a relationship. So love, joy, peace. The buzz, the excitement of a new relationship, the fun of a new friendship. And then it goes on and you realise that the person isn't as perfect as you once thought. patience, kindness, goodness. The expectations of each other are more aligned over time. And then you meet the people who've been married for like 50 years. What is your secret? Faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. What links these nine things together? Well, they all involve other people. They are relational words. Words like compliance aren't there because that's a contract word. The fruit of the Spirit are about growing relationships, growing brilliant, joy-filled relationships. Ones that aren't broken by immoral physical intimacy or spiritual manipulation or bad attitudes or a loss of self-control, but dominated by a growth of love, joy, peace. Do you know what an oxymoron is? Sounds like a slightly veiled insult, doesn't it? Look at them. They're an oxymoron. It's when two opposing words are put together to make a point. Things like awfully nice, deafening silence, contractual Christianity. Here's why you're an oxymoron for believing contractual Christianity. Because 2,000 years ago, your contract was ripped apart. If Jesus hadn't died on the cross, you'd still be under contract. You'd still have to live like an Old Testament Jew. You'd need to go to the temple where the massive, thick curtain that would be between you and God would remind you that you and him are under contract. That curtain was a constant declaration that you and God could only mix when certain criteria were met. What did Jesus do? When he died on the cross, that massive contract was ripped in half from top to bottom. Jesus, in taking my punishment for sin, paid the legal requirement of me breaking the contract. There was no more repeated sacrifice for sins that were needed, because the ultimate sacrifice had been paid. Contractual Christianity is rubbish because it says that Jesus wasn't enough. That's what got Paul so angry. Jesus paid the punishment for my sin, and now I get to grow both horizontally and vertically in the fruit of the Spirit. Horizontally with each other and vertically with God. Look at the end of verse 23. Against such things, there is no law. You're not going to get to heaven and be accused of being too joyful. The law says that you should only be joyful on Tuesdays. It's rubbish. Against such things, there is no law. You can't grow too much fruit of the Spirit. So what does it mean to be free? Are you a person who views Christianity as slavery? Paul says, outside of a relationship with Christ, you are a slave. You are a slave to your ever hungry flesh, and will be feeding it until it dies. If that's you, then please take some time today to look into the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, because it was done so that you could be free. But Aaron, I'm a Christian and I feel these things. I want to do them. It may mean that you need additional help to give up some of those things in the list. But in the everyday, what do I do when I'm tempted to gratify these desires? What do I do when I'm tired, sad, alone, and I just can't be bothered? What do I do when the Spirit is fighting the flesh? You go to the cross, and you look up and remind yourself of verse 24. Those who follow Jesus see their desires dying on the cross with Christ. You remind yourself that Jesus thought you were worth dying for. You remind yourself that because of what he has done, he is the only one that calls you to freedom. Everything else is slavery. Brothers and sisters, you have been called by God to be free. Christ paid the punishment and ripped up your contract. So don't use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. Don't you want to be part of a church that builds these things? Don't you want to see a growing, Jesus-centered, Spirit-filled church? I realise things have been hard recently, but the Holy Spirit is not on lockdown. So let's strive forward together, growing the fruit of the Spirit. You do me a favour, can you make sure to reread this before you go to bed tonight? Tell God that you want to start that walk with Him, and then tomorrow wake up and start the walk of freedom alongside thousands of others who are walking with you. We are free to serve, free to be led, and free to grow together. You are called to be free.